Hey guys, I'm going to make a start. So probably most of you know these guys better than I do, apart from Mike, but for those of you who don't, we have tonight Paul Casey, Anthony Owen, Jonathan Morley and Mike and Kim, all of whom are published with Heaven Tree Press, which is Jonathan Morley's own press. They've been doing a tour of Ireland and this is their last gig. They're going to read for about 10 minutes each. Paul's going to go first, then Anthony, then Jonathan, then Mike. I just ask you to make sure that you've got your mobile phones switched off so that there aren't any irritating noises in the middle of it, apart from the sound of my voice, obviously. And once the reading's finished, we'll be having a wine reception in the Shane Mattini Centre. So for those of you who've just come from the other wine reception, some more of those to be had later. So I'll let the guys introduce themselves because they've been doing this tour for about a week, so they'll be much more adept at it than me.
Thanks, Miriam. It's great to be in Belfast again, and especially on this occasion. We've just completed a tour of Ireland of poetry readings in some of the main centres in Ireland, as well as some of the more remote areas. Cork and Coventry are twin cities, so we have an exchange which is thriving at the moment, and we're trying to encourage other cities to do the same, because it's very fruitful and eye-opening. I've got five poems for you this evening, because two of them are slightly longer. I won't take too long, too much of your time. The Weight of Water. On the occasion of the dawning of the age of Aquarius, February 14th, 2009, between 7:25 a.m. and 7:43 a.m. A spring sea arrives, all drowned in flailing sage, clutches my lime-white soles from beneath the fresh hunger of sod. Don't leave me, be at one with me, the things to come. Still seeping and airbound, apples on the cusp of an inner eclipse, I turn to olive water. Nothing can be at rest beneath this marble ichor moon of all things opaque and aquamarine. From further inland, this world is still, but not here at daybreak's shoreline, where stone-pale waves struggle to reach the long shore of petrified seals, heaving to shift and break the aging jade spell. The sea casts wide its turquoise daydreams, helpless, crashing and raging at the same thirsty white sun they still long to temper. And the ocean sighs call louder to all these amethyst children who have ever crawled out from her murky clear womb to gaze and stand uncertain at ice slowly gleaming teal or a firm vapor of dream. The next poem I'm going to read is from the book. It's called Skinani the Poet, and it's about a poet who decides to join the commercial film industry and how he sees that in terms of poetry. It's a bit technical, so don't worry about those. Some of the words are Skinani the Poet. One day traded his pencil for a lens and his paper for a reel. He wrote these new poems, eye-ear poems, poetless poems. Skinani the poet one day sent his very eyes into exile, into plots, to breathe, you see. Skinani the poet now swam in a new sea of satire. Iambic celluloid, anapestic f-stop, dactylic actors, an alliteration of lighting and a versification of visions. Skinani the poet was in a very different sea of sound effects, of irony, a sea of modern prosody, of new closed forms. Ask Petrarchan Skinani for a modern sunrise sonnet and you'll receive, when aiming camera, just make sure to think, that all the mise-en-scene is balanced well, that all the actors have their lines to tell, that shades and hues and shadows are in sync, when if you need your players not to blink, to shield their eyes from sun's own jealous yell, to fan and nudge their egos to excel, make sure to look as if you're on the brink of breaking through to poetry unseen, of bringing through the actor's greatest day, of culminating new creations dreamed. For when the thespian instinct will not play, suspects the charioteer about to fold, the last word of each line is never told. Ask too of Scanani, an ancient anamorphic quatrain, and he'll smile in plain and say another sonnet, two tercets, two quatrains, opus historium, Clio hysterium. Ask laboured Scanani while placing a prop, a limerick to requite, and he'll recite, there was an old actor from yore, who thought that to film was a bore, till he moved all his grace from his hands to his face, and entered the stage nevermore. Scanani the poet was in a completely different sea of emotion and morality. Ask him for a villanelle, and he'll answer with five tercets and a set dressing quatrain. I found a poet in me, and sighed when me he saw an artist finally free. The road to mastery. A softened, cheerful paw. An artist finally free. I found a poet in me. My apologies. Unraveling mystery with feathered forms a claw, an artist finally free. I now could speak with tree, have arguments with flaw. I found a poet in me. To flee or not to flee, a danger to the law, an artist finally free. It's best I climb a tree, there with a crow as I'll call. I found a poet in me, an artist finally free. Cinquain, sexten, rondel, rondo, rundel, rondo y doble, un triolet of sea asked for a haiku. Swift sun, surgeon, shining seas, 90-page screenplay. A movement and a motion. Scanani the poet was worrying now in this very different sea of symbols and imagery, a sea of newly dreamed cities, of new open forms, of scripted cobblers, ad-lib odes, of couplet cameos, a rhyming montage of troubadouric flashbacks, of scheduled epigrams and filtered ballads. Delirious Scanani the poet was panicking now in this completely different simile sea. Terza rima shutter speeds, pantoum close-ups, virilae ancien clapperboards, continuity ballads, virilae nouveau light meters, and focus-pulling glosa. Onomatopoeic stampeding crowds, new phonetic zoomings, homeoprophoron animal handlers, makeup consonant swindlers, and assonant stunt predictors, the rhythm and effect of accelerating producers sustaining Pierre Cabrado atmospheres, the phonetic rhetoric of the assistant director, and talkie iteratio of the walkie-talkie, lipograms and inner dialogue analepha of discernment, the caesura of discretion. Scanani the poet, staring at the rhyming cast and crew, at the unrhyming entirety, simply shook his head. Rich rhyme, mirror rhyme, identity rhyme, virtual rhyme, indecasyllabo, Gallic decasyllable, Alexandrines, iambic pentameter, all mercilessly sent to the slaughter of booms and gates and gels and mics, and of avant-garde, gung-ho, fame, spangles, hotheads. Da, 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 for the nursery rhyme advocates, who lose, iambically, take ten, a trochaic action, anapestically, it's a rap, in the can. Dactylic filmistry, an amphibraic filtration of spondaic faux pas and pyrrhic edits, Scanani's stress patterns and tightrope meters, designer syllables, all lost, drowned, realized Scanani the poet by the conquering camera and the seventh art. The Peru harp for Liz. I first saw her set amid the dust-stained light and clutter of a Norman castle hall. Walked faceless through furnished ether to win her over with my timid surrender. Filthy and proud. E and F strings of the high octave both missing. I ease her shoulder into mine. Curve falls oaken. Neck finds palm, a reflex catch of hands circles their partner to waltz, first brushes the silver rain to call nectar's breath from long parched willow depths. Fingers widen, awaken arpeggio, eager to release a future and past interwoven, a lone giant shifts. The sweep of pillar flows beyond her faintly etched reaching arc, along the clear rainbow of sound. To rest in pools of storms long gone, where they tease the dance of time. The next poem was inspired by my dentist when he was charting my teeth to his assistant, and it sounded very poetic to me, so I asked him if he'd record that and if I could make a poem with it. And this is it. It's called Painless. I'm at my new dentist's with a loose crown. He holds up the x-rayed future of my diet, an orthopantograph of secrets to chart the teeth that shaped my every word. Upper right one, bridge retained. Memory sinks into the trembling nuclei of my own electricity, a shaman's drug, a ritual for visions and childhood seconds. Was ever pain the root of wisdom? Upper right two, pontic of a bridge. He smiles, Lipizzano white. Well, you've certainly been around the block. If only you knew, Doc, what some horses had to go through for extensive occlusal wear. Upper right three, retainer of a bridge. At first appointments, I open wide, expecting shock. I wait for something like Jesus Christ Almighty. I muse on how they don't even blink, manage to avoid the right words. Upper right four, MOD composite. His deja vu posture conjures all of my very own dentists, flashing by now like needles. I can't remember exactly how many, yet only these strangers have ever seen my thoughts this closely, could somehow know me where most have not. Upper right five, missing. I've been to so many dentists that any nerves not removed by pulpectomy have receded up into the safety of my nostrils, perhaps even my eyes and brain. Upper right six, crown. I remember beaming up at a dentist in the Curragh when I was eight, thinking, wow, women are dentists too. An upper brace for a crooked incisor, just great. No school though, here's to you. Upper right seven, core and crown. The perfume of prosthetics, amalgam of that pink moulding powder, and the faint but distinctive superiority of dentist breath. Upper left one, distal angle. Switch off my nose, please. This time chair reminds me I've had so many root canals that I don't need anesthetic. Upper left two, distal angle. I've always loved my teeth, though something in my sleep would slowly grind the mind with the adventures of sweets. How many nights Dad would ease a dollop of sacred whiskey deep into an aching corner to float me tearlessly away. Upper left three, missing. I remember a big city dentist whose posture leant over me at an angle slightly proportionate to my health cover. Upper left four, DO. Astutely aware of the minute hand movements, the variations in pressure, bracing for the jolt of steel slamming into a nerve. Upper left five, MOD and mobility. I exhume more buried treasure, a jackhammer vibrating brain cells. Perhaps if I defeated pain, then I wouldn't have to feel it again. Lower left one to four, present, wishing for a masochism button, waiting for that drill to burst right through my teeth and beyond. When pain becomes a friend, something must be wrong. Lower left five, MOD, amalgam. There's good news, though, for one who never used to speak much, as telepathic powers unfold, increase exponentially. Lower left six, missing. For the frustration of not being free to answer interesting conversation, unable to nod, primal sounds. Lower left seven, MO. A country dentist who for pocket change arranged a root canal and abscess bonus. Rough dentists, most of which are gentle enough. Lower right, 1 to 3, present. A distracted dentist who, while talking of goals, broke off the side of a wisdom, leaving me to swallow the blame. It was going anyway, never mind, Doc. There's much more to worry about out there. Lower right, 4, missing. I've had the best of entertainment from dentists. A tiny dentist lady who once assumed an exotic yoga contortion to extract a stubborn molar. Knees and legs all over the place. Lower right 5, MO mesial buccal composite. An up and close real live heroine she was, piercing my fantasies with the most clinical ice blue a woman could ever offer. Now that's education. Lower right 6, missing. I would have made a great dentist. One thing I always found odd, though, was the long-drawn closeness of eyes, details only a lover should know. Lower right seven, missing. They are all lust lovers, each an image of fascination, finely tattooed onto a chronology of painless recollections. They're better than any psychologist. I've learned psychology from dentists. Lower right 8, MO amalgam. As he finishes, I tip tongue along the peaks and crevices, valleys of gum only Odysseus would dare. All these and more have witnessed my submolecular hero who celebrates in slippery leaps from filling to crown, his triumphant emergence, his victorious trophy of mouthwash. They have traced my life as casually as an old palm reader. I suddenly long to thank each one with a bright embrace. Painless as an x-ray, I rise from the chair, gather all that care, inhale the light of day. I have one very short one that I'm going to finish with. It's a very recent, which actually has an introduction way longer, and I'm not going to go into it. It's really just the explanation of what N-theory is. I'm sure most of you would have heard of N-theory. How many people haven't heard of N-theory? Well, it's a theoretical physics, essentially. It's probably the latest. It's among the string theory. Have you heard of string theory?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really, it would have been sort of the final level of string theory that has to date been theorized.
Memory? M for memory.
But it's not about memory. It's for a multiverse, in fact. Not universe, but multiverses and parallel universes and such. And so, M-theory. And thank you very much. I dreamt of M-theory last night after seeing the Vagina Monologues, a masterpiece, and became a trans-multiversal salmon, flipping through worlds till I felt too alone to shed my scales or to expand into life. So returned, became clay, and then flesh again. Wished I was a vagina for a day, and explained to the other physicists that the primary substance of the multiverse and everything outside of it is imagination, and that beyond that again is up to yourself, of course. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul. Great reading. Just want to thank everyone for coming tonight. You've lent me your ear, so I'll try and give you some poetry. I'll just get straight into it. The first one's not from a collection of my father's Eyes Were Blue. It's a new one. It's the only new one I'm going to read. It's called The Goblet Soldier. Where he uttered his mother's name, letters wrote, ink swirled in syrup puddles. Through his fist arches, a silver chain led to a goblet darling face. So ornate it shone through blood. He let go of him in a cloud of chokes. Men became mountain and river, of buoyed eyes opening and closing. Wives and mothers sailed like ships to limbs, all of their sons harbours. Today he sailed a guild of names. At Edward Powell he murmured a prayer. His fingers rested in surname Swilcott's. I'll be waking you soon, you lazy sods. He left the salute hanging from a cross. It had a face so ornate that it shone in fleck paint shadows. Thank you. The next poem is called My Father's Eyes Are Blue, the title collection. Anvil-eyed, my father glanced at me. Dress me well for Karen, he said. He drew breaths like a daisy lamp, as I brushed his hair with steady hands. My father was Sicilian, the miners called him Brando, my mother called him Darling, and he left for work golden, returning a shadow who stained my lips black. He'd sit by my bed, stroking my hair, coaling my forehead. I knew he kissed me every night, for I awoke in tattoos from where he held me, reading me Whitman while I slept. He had no last words for me, just a smile and a squeeze of my hand, and he was 23 again in a Daimler with Karen, driving to Loch Lomond with 42 shillings, 2 smiles, 2 rings, and her father's wrath. The next one's called Half Moon on Hanover Street. Kelly. In your womb rainbow, he looked like black grain. A mouthless doctor spoke of how to breathe in July when the flower unfurled. I stitched his name in silver, kept him safe in Latin yachts, breathing towards the moon northward to cumulus shores. He arrived still as moon. July saw his rebirth a half moon on Hanover Street. I kissed his mother there beneath swan-necked lampposts. In the space between our lips, he fastened a family of three, from two breaths and a name we could finally say together. Field over Chung Ek. This poem is about the massacre in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge rule. In Novotel Blue, a temple French smokes. This Marlborough suckling fans thin Buddhas to good time Englishmen in tuk tuk plumes last night in joystick vapours. Prayer smoke transported her to acres of lemongrass, bowing to her as she ran in zigzags the way she was taught in the school years. Fields are curved now, bringing bartering shadows of vulgar dialects, back alley exaltations, his thigh hairs lemongrass from her Khmer Rouge hands. 2,000 prayers away, a field of lemongrass will be etched with zigzags, and her thigh hairs will tremble like pollen over Chung Ek. My blue lover rages. I used to have them stand, it's all organised, it's great. On goosebump dunes, brunette waves fell sideward, moon weaved a salt frock of fish silver. She swayed in seagrass, wishing upon a zodiac of the offshore oil rig. We lay numeral, melting from a Dali clock, my big hands on your little hands, our 12th hour thighs announcing a chime of lips. Storm. My lover's Atlantic mouth, spumed with driftwood, wrapped in stinking veins, cold, steamed a ghost ship. My compass set at north, slipped through my fingers, facing south to where she frothed, whispering the new world's name. And two more and I'm done. The bludgeoning quilt. I painted my nails for you, held you like rosary, tearing your bread of spine apart, wrestling our sheets, stained with merlot. I painted my love for you in lip, lobe and lashes, my body your abstract expression, a pollock of scratches. Sunrise on yester sheets, your fecal nylon mould wears my mouth banshee, dancing in a still wind by a bludgeoning quilt. Final poem, attempting a really bad Irish accent. So get the gibbet out. You can hang me afterwards. Da bought me a watch, heavy as a guilty troth. I wore them both that day with a keen wrist and backhand, for I lost it on the dune doing gambols out of earshot. I was Mara's angel, but me Dara's divil. When I said I lost the watch, me Dara shouted, "Jesus!" And I screamed, "Jesus!" followed by Mar. Jesus came in a buckle. Me Mar came upstairs, pleading for the letter. But Darry Floyd in spittle and steel, and seven lashes with me sister's age added for an example. This went on and on till 40 years later. Jesus took me Dar, and I buried him in me wife's face, beating her for surfacing me devils. So what am I? Me wife says nothing, and I am her silence. And that is that. Thank you. John Small. That's beautiful.
Very good reading. It's the last date on our tour tonight. It's been a wonderful week, really, and I'd just like to thank publicly Paul Casey, who's been our tour manager, as well as one of the poets on the tour, and also to Miriam Gamble and the East Shane Senior Centre for having us here tonight. I'll start with a riddle. My enemy me murdered, stretched my skin across slats, then scraped, shaved with semicircular blade, and dusted by slender stroking hands, anointed in the everlasting colours of the peacock. Tattooed, tickled with grey goose feathers, a pine martin's soft brush, I alchemize, scrutinized by anxious faces, and blown by breath. What am I?
Are you
Right, this poem is called Iberian Baroque. It's a Catholic poem in some ways. It's written not about Ireland, but about Portugal, when I went there touring around Portugal 2 years ago. And it's in the voice of a stone head, which I found in a Portuguese cathedral called the Igreja de São Francisco in Porto. Aztec or Inca, I stare granite-eyed from an arch of grey stone. Wreaths of stone flowers curve in the arch whose foot is on my head. No gold. Other heads are set about me. Animals, beaver from Labrador, jaguara from the January River. Larger than mine, my head was shrunk to allow for the enlarged earlobes. No gold on this stone totem. Around, beyond the chain of the arch, everything is gold. Heaven. I saw this scrawl on shields and mashed feathers when Quetzalcoatl, feathered snake, appeared from the east as a bearded man. Heard it uttered when my father was given a feather, chained in a circle of dirt and made to fight snake men with fangs of steel. Commend thy soul. Windward, through waves of gold, five men are beheaded in Morocco. One, Dishtulp, in neck snapped like tulip. Two, hair in fist of turbaned warrior. All round-eyed, staring at the gold, futile poor martyrs of Morocco. Somewhere diagonal, blind, another head, not like mine, peers from the root of a tree where are hung many ghosts. At its tip, a woman in blue cradling her child's body. The head with round cheeks of a child supports the weight of a tree, and above a child tribe clusters gold, gold, though sun has smouldered, black and sad in smoke of years, and below the roots of the place are marble, white roots as of mountain, and even in its caverns, skulls are scarred like trophies gleaming in the ink black, chattering through trapdoors down to the dried up bilges and shifting floor of bones. Now, I was rather perturbed to step in the lecture theatre here and see Philip Larkin's name on a blue plaque on the wall out there. I'd like to read this one, I think, in sight of it. Larkin was born in Coventry, where I live and where Tony lives, and he's a real pain in the arse, and he can't do anything without making a Larkin small, petty-minded, misogynistic, provincial ghost hovering over you. So this is my Andrew Larkin poem. Written in an un-Larkin-esque style, as you can get, you know, chopping words up and splintering the poem up rather than doing his mannered, polite, small-minded side of it. It's called Bomb. Coventry was notoriously bombed quite heavily in the Blitz. And the first IRA bomb. A
to tell you, I suppose, to be let off in the UK, where it was in Coventry in 1932, in a post box just near where I live. Bomb for Larkin. The syllables, the syllabic intelligence. Cathedra arises in every shape of sky, yellow lettering like an eye. Renome it Noventry, each oblong and triangle now scar with blue of no sky. Nail varnish blue, clutch, flesh grey town, as choke, road. The way I, dear, flat pack and choice you on flower, deforest you stamp the boot, power on you, brute root and cow, hard you. Your livid runes, identity, squat, uniformed blue with nail yellow scab lame, our gorillas will cast out to the boroughs of Spon End, hill fields, the Victorian sewers, the riddle of entries. Down there, Herzl, Kersey, Fozil, spite all the slurred elves of this liquid shitty whittles or lurch below, and blow your ghost town, great house flat, down.
I'll do two more. This is called For Lee Miller. In the bleak washroom, its motel cramp, your elf's face cynical, tired. The metronome poised below your eyes, a damsel out of Picasso, the glow dimmed that has flooded the dark rooms of uncounted hearts, the luminous one. The little Fuhrer watches you bathe from his frame on the bath's corner, fist at his hip, chest thrust out. Often he must have stood to attention in the shower, practicing faces, the pipes applauding da, 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 da. You'll write for Vogue that the place is well stocked with wines and whiskies for a teetotaler in Birchdas Garden. Heated walls you wired back in June from Cologne, and the bloody clawed handmarks of the roasting victims baked like the designs on pottery. The inhabitants must have known. Now steam mars his pristine grey tiles, a ghost of fingerprints near the tap. Piero completes the set. Facing him on a polished table, a foot-high nude stroking her stone-blonde hair, elbow mimicking your elbow's gesture for washing a collarbone alabaster. And do your triptych of faces consciously echo that threesome you described as the hangover to a great party you just missed in Leipzig? In one of the offices, a grey-haired man at his desk with head bowed on crossed hands, sprawled in a chair, his faded wife, a stitch of blood down her chin. Dusty nurse daughter with pretty teeth, stretched on the sofa in dreamless sleep. That SS guard you snapped, his face moonwhite beneath the glass canal. Nude's breasts and stomach are waxen, bulge like yours in those maddening photographs taken by your Pygmalion father when you were 21. Your boots cue like men. Face it, Hitler's bath mat with the mud of Dachau. And finally, I'll do a poem called On the Macclesfield Psalter. I went to see the Book of Kells this morning. Hey, I revealed the riddle! it was a car. It was a car. In England, we have a fascinating illuminated manuscript. And what I thought this morning was, very different. The Book of Kells is so majestic, so stately. It obviously has deep spiritualism in the artwork and these neat and beautiful illuminated letters. The idea of a peacock, which is a bird that Christian myth had it, that its flesh didn't rot when it died. So the book is like a peacock because it will never rot, in these beautiful colours, feather colours. And in England we have the Macclesfield Psalter. It's rather different. There's this strange little pages with the Psalms in Latin on them. And it's like the scribes have got bored when they're copying them out. And there's little almost cartoons all kind of scribbled all around the side of it, the equivalent of laboratory scribblings, I suppose, on this, very sacrosanct medieval book, it's very different to the illuminated manuscripts you have over here. So this was just my response to that book, On the Macclesfield Psalter. Saddle me up a giant duck with teeth like serrated knives. Rig me in motley, fox mask, fish scale, king in this republic of apparitions conjured by a moon. Raise me an earl of rabbits, thumbnail small, pricking his ears up, scenting the sweet doe, and shoot him in the back, or set a hound to joust and pierce him, so the rabbits scream, "Murder! Murder!" bearing him on a bier with censer and mitre through the native holes. Paint me a maiden with taut, flat stomach, curtains of curling hair, and eyes twisting from chivalrous lover to a rough-beard suitor in green, feet gnarling into roots, with such a smirk of lust catching her lips to make future owners scratch out her face, and turn the poor swain's ass to a fish head, coiling tongue, the psalm's opening unseal. Make my eel man point up there, so your eyes are thrown across the vellum, but here be a she-frog aiming at his breadbasket. The arc of her arrows points leftward, and this swings the eye back like a hammock back to where he points among cut words, the Latin rippling like a stony sea mesmeric in the rhythm of a prayer. I'd like to hand you over to Heaven Tea Press's newest acquisition, the young Ulster poet, the Antrim poet Michael McKim.
Cheers, and thanks Miriam for organising this. It's the great finale to our tour. And start with a North Antrim poem. Sarahhead. She made her bedroom so it didn't face the other houses of the Clachan, but instead looked only at the place where sky was a lung tug of gravity on the edge of the cliff, a drop to boulders, granite spikes, the channel of sea. This was her retirement. No more the large house she couldn't heat, no more the stairs, only the two rooms, the scuttle, the knick-knacks, the breath of the wind in the night and the day. She'd go as she came, in a bed a foot from the soil, in a cottage without running water, with the yelp of the dogs in the field, the odd hovering falcon, and every so often when the day was clear, the cliff face and mountains of Scotland. And I live in London now, and I was in the underground once in Oxford Circus Station, and suddenly the lights went out just for a second. Like, they just cut out and it was all pitch black, but it came on immediately again. But I wrote this poem, The Underground. When the lights went out in the station, and the shrill of panic rose as some people walked. Sorry, I'll start again. When the lights went out in the station, and the shrill of panic rose as some people stopped and others kept on walking, I thought of mining and the heat of mines, the cage going down with the men packed and joking, the taste of the first cigarette still tart on their lips, then the smell of the coal or salt or sulphur, especially the sulphur, the great stenches of the innards of the earth, the way the skin, litmus-like, imbibes the dust and grit, the mass of molecules in the air, the way our throats are closing now the more we breathe, and how all week there's been this talk of switching off the lights. I thought of this as a fear entered my groin, like butterflies who find themselves too far south in spring, their wings singed and browning at the edges. And I work for the Geological Society, and in London, and this poem is about sort of the first major geologist, Charles Lyell. And it's about him in his later years. He goes on a holiday to New Hampshire, and he sees what he had been told about in this bit of New Hampshire that made him write The Principles of Geology, which is sort of was the first major geological text, and it's still, you know, well, I'll read it. The Granite State. New Hampshire, 1845. The Amonoosuck River tumbles white and grey below Mount Washington, where, like factory carts in the black pits of the north, they spill towards the summit. 8 horses, heavy laden with buckets, satchels, notebooks and knives, navigating through boulders on the well-worn path, a stodgy mule taking the rear, hooves cracking on dark flint. Lyle, the geologist, a butterfly net pendulating from his saddle like a metronome as they pitch uphill, hoists a piece of rock from the tundra and scrapes the lichen delicately onto a glass. He loves these moments when he gets into the field, caresses the elements, lets his mind feed. He notes how the cloud shadows unveil the banded colours of the trees and the lakes shining like silver. Yesterday, with the kind guidance of locals, he stood in the clearing at Crawford's Notch, where the land slipped one afternoon and crushed the Williams family without a moment's notice, all nine out with the crops or painting the white fences, thoughts on the evening meal. They turned to see the mountain fall and could not run. They left life in the sudden shift, the glacial past. Arctic plants and hemlock, balsam fir, white pine and spruce. He breathes wide mountain air. Still young, he thinks, eyeing the valley. Still young enough to change the world again. He thinks mountains and landscape and lineage. He thinks granite. He is thinking of the highlands he walked in his youth, of the island of Arran. He sees in the granite the kindred thing. Two more. I went on holiday to Ibiza, which sounds unlikely. we were up there staying with some friends in this beautiful villa up in the hills, and we didn't go near any. So I'm just sort of sitting by the pool in the heat for the whole week. I don't drive, so we couldn't really go anywhere, so we were kind of just stuck there. And so I wrote this, and it's called Blue, and it's got an epigraph by Vincent van Gogh. What I should like to find out is the effect of an intenser blue in the sky. Blue. One. Midnight. A moonlight feathering the sea between Punta Galera and South Coniera, and beyond that too. So where the lighthouse pinpricks the darkness is like the prow of a great ship anchored down but rocking, its crew and captain slumbering towards daybreak. Landmass is what complements the water, not the other way around. The blueness is the ink invading crevices in paper that says if needed it could accomplish all. At night it is still blue, almost navy where it creeps into the cove, a fabric woven with salt, plankton, sea flints, beneath a startling sky, needled by Venus. Two. Do we adapt to the noise of a lawnmower the way we get used to the rasp of cicadas, these daybugs existing in phonics, powerful, unseen? Maybe they keep us sane in the stillness, where nothing moves in the air, too hot for birds, and the wind is a tepid thing. Between myself and the horizon there are 15 shades of blue, the lagoon of the swimming pool, dark blobs on terracotta lanterns, a hue on branches, Hums mountains, cobalt rivets and burnt rocks, afterflow and stretch marks on the sea, turning in like furrows in a field. The sky itself is first invented blue, assured and unsurpassed, the blue of void and distance. Three. On the streets of Ibiza, we hypothesize lamplit fingers, St. Cyriac guiding the Catalans through the walls of the city. Battlements so thick that tunnels run inside them, and all that's known is what is felt in darkness. Cobbles and earth-dry bricks, a broken stone, the curve of a pathway, the echo of footsteps, and what's recorded only by its absence, the colour of clothing, the shape of a smile. Funny how we think thought craves the darkness, when really the migraine of light is what we always head for. Fresh air, the wide birthright of sky, all that's wanted and perpetual and elusive. And I'm going to finish with a new one that I wrote on the other day. On Saturday night, we were staying in West Cork, in furthest westerly point of Cork, in a place called Alahees. And this is called At Al-Hiz. And thanks to Paul for taking us there. At Al-Hiz. As if it wasn't enough that we saw the stone chat on the fence post feeding its chick down on the loose barbed wire, or that we were surrounded by a lush enriching mist that seemed to hold the land as tight as cuckoo spit. You gave us a happy as Larry unsuspecting hare, a kestrel high in the hills, snowy moss at the window. You gave us a verdant river thick with ferns, foxgloves, cotton grass, hundreds of wildflowers. Spirit, you gave to us the shadows on relentless towering rocks, the night clouds sculpting the sky. O Spirit of Al-Hiz, you gave us this exclusively, quietly. And then, in a second's unfathomable liftoff, you let the sunlight burn through the mist. You gave us the horizon. You gave us eagerness, persistence. You gave us the open road. Thanks so much.